form a papyrus petition, and the court has had to devise special methods of handling such cases because of the special difficulties they present. The papyrus petitions, Justice Frankfurter once wrote, are often almost unintelligible and certainly do not present a clear statement of issues necessary for our understanding. Their meager content can be contrasted with the information that the man of means is required to supply when he files a petition for certiorari. The rules require him to show the jurisdictional basis for Supreme Court review, including the time when he raised his federal questions. He must print the text of the lower court's opinions in the case, and he must supply at least one typewritten copy of the transcript of the trial court proceedings. Prisoners rarely supply any of this material in their informa pauperis petitions. The result is that there is often great difficulty even figuring out what happened to the prisoner, what the case is all about. Lower court opinions would be informative, but in the prisoner's case, the lower courts rarely bother to write any. That was true with Gideon. The Florida Supreme Court had turned him down in a stereotype order making no reference to the facts of his case. All it said was, "The above-named petitioner has filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the above cause, and upon consideration thereof, it is ordered that said petition be and the same is hereby denied." Not very helpful to a justice in Washington trying to find out what was decided in Florida. The burden of the pauper's cases has been steadily growing heavier in the Supreme Court. In recent years, their number has increased much more sharply than the volume of business on the regular docket. 25 years ago, fewer than 100 informa pauperis cases were filed each term. The number passed 1,000 in the 1949 term, and for the first time exceeded the volume of prepaid appellate cases. Now there are about 1,500 each term. The court itself has taken a broad view of the statute allowing poor persons to file without formalities. It said in 1948 that one need not be absolutely destitute to qualify. In that case, Justice Hugo L. Black wrote, "We think an affidavit is sufficient which states that one cannot, because of poverty, pay or give security for the costs and still be able to provide himself and dependents with the necessities of life. Otherwise, an impoverished man would have to choose between his family and his cause, perhaps abandoning what may be a meritorious claim in order to spare himself complete destitution." As a practical matter, the court seldom second-guesses a man's own declaration of poverty in an informa pauperis affidavit. Few of the pauper's petitions turn out to be worth the Supreme Court's time. Only about 3% are granted, as compared with approximately 13% of the petitions for certiorari on the regular docket. The prisoner's claims, Justice William O. Douglas has said, are often fantastic, surpassing credulity. They are, for the most part, frivolous. One recent petitioner said he was a descendant of the Spanish grandee of Southern California and thus owned all the land. Given the difficulty of processing all these applications, it would be understandable if the court did not try very hard to find the occasional needle in the haystack. But as Justice Walter V. Schaefer of the Illinois Supreme Court once said of a comparable problem, "It is not a needle we are looking for in these stacks of paper, but the rights of a human being." And so, the Supreme Court has devised a careful procedure for sifting the frequently incomprehensible documents that pour in from the country's prisons. Justice Douglas has said he is confident that this procedure dispenses justice at a level long neglected in the nation. The Gideon case was handled in the usual way for informa pauperis cases. Gideon's handwritten papers were held for 30 days, in their red envelope, to allow time for a reply from the Florida authorities. They knew of his petition because he had been required by the rules to mail a copy to the named respondent, H.G. Cochran, Jr., head of the Florida prison system. But the states rarely answer prisoners' petitions, and there was no response to Gideon's during the 30 days. When that time was up, on February 8, 1962, the papers were sent to the office of Chief Justice Earl Warren. The Chief Justice's three law clerks have the special duty of scrutinizing the informa pauperis applications. He has three instead of the two clerks allotted to other justices so that this arduous job can be done. One of the clerks prepares a typewritten memorandum on each case, stating what the claim appears to be and any relevant legal framework. The memorandum is then circulated among the nine justices. If the claim seems to be a serious one, and in all cases of prisoners under death sentence, the original red envelope containing the application is attached to the law clerk's memorandum when it is circulated. In any case, a justice can call for the file. If a case raises a question that the law clerk examining the file thinks may interest the court, he may suggest to the Chief Justice, even before the papers are circulated, that the state authorities be asked to file a response. The hope is that a response may clarify the legal issues, fill in the factual background, and bring out any obstacles to the court's taking jurisdiction of the case. That is what was done in Gideon's case. The Chief Justice's office instructed the clerk's office, which sends all such communications, to call for a response. On March 8, 1962, Michael Rodak, Jr., the assistant clerk who had originally handled Gideon's petition, sent this letter to the Attorney General of Florida, Richard W. Urban. R.E. Gideon V. Cochran, Number 890, Miscellaneous, October Term, 1961. Dear Sir, on January 8, 1962, Clarence Earl Gideon, an inmate of the Florida State Prison at Rayford, filed a petition for writ of certiorari in this court to review the order of the Supreme Court of Florida, dated October 30, 1961, in the above-entitled case. Our records indicate that you have been served with a copy of the petition. The court has directed this office to request that you file a response to the petition. One typewritten copy of your response, together with proof of service thereof, should reach this office on or before April 7, 1962. John F. Davis, Clerk, by Michael Rodak, Jr., Assistant. On April 9th, the court received a brief in opposition, signed by Attorney General Urban and one of his assistants, Bruce R. Jacob. It was 13 typewritten pages, and it sounded one theme. Gideon had not been entitled to trial counsel under the rule of the 1942 decision in Betts v. Brady, that the Constitution guaranteed free counsel to indigent defendants in state criminal cases only when special circumstances showed that a fair trial would otherwise be impossible. The brief reviewed the cases since Betts v. Brady, and then rested on the indisputable fact that Gideon had never even claimed to be the victim of any special disabilities which would bring him within the rule of that case. Petitioner Gideon, the brief said, has made no affirmative showing of any exceptional circumstances which would entitle him to counsel under the 14th Amendment. There has been presented no evidence of petitioner's maturity or capacity of comprehension. Petitioner merely alleges that he was without funds, that he pleaded not guilty, and that he requested court-appointed counsel while being tried on a non-capital charge. The petition contains no allegations as to petitioner's age, experience, mental capacity, familiarity or unfamiliarity with court procedure, or as to the complexity of the legal issues presented by the charge. All these were factors that had been held to produce special circumstances under the Betts rule. Petitioner has made no showing of unfairness or of a lack of fundamental justice in the trial proceedings. In fact, his petition is notable for its lack of material allegations such as would entitle him to counsel under the 14th Amendment. Since there have been no allegations as to exceptional circumstances, the presumption must be indulged that the trial proceedings were fair and just. The one thing notable about the response, to an outside observer, was its assumption that the rule of Betts v. Brady was inviolate. The possibility that the court might be prepared to overrule it was never considered. The response ended with a certification by Assistant Attorney General Jacob that he had mailed a copy to Mr. Clarence Earl Gideon in proper person, Box 221, Rayford, Florida. On April 21st, the court received a reply brief from Gideon. It was 4 pages long, again written in pencil, and it began with a modest disclaimer. Petitioner cannot make any pretense at being able to answer the learned Attorney General of Florida, Gideon wrote. because the petitioner is not attorney or versed in law, nor does not have the law books to copy down the decisions of this court. But the petitioner knows there is many of them. The reply brief stuck resolutely to the simple proposition Gideon had argued from the beginning. The respondent claims, it said, that a citizen can get an equal and fair trial without legal counsel. Petitioner will attempt to show this court that a citizen of the state of Florida cannot get a just and fair trial without the aid of counsel. If the petitioner would have had attorney, there would not have been allowed such things as hearsay, perjury, or bill of attainder against him. It makes no difference how old I am, or what color I am, or what church I belong to, if any. The question is, I did not get a fair trial. The question is very simple. I requested the court to appoint me attorney, and the court refused. The reply was, in fact, telling in its simplicity. It makes no difference how old I am, or what color I am, or what church I belong to, if any. Intended or not, that sentence was an effective parody of the sophisticated reasoning that in past years had determined, under the special circumstances approach, whether a man should have had a free lawyer at his trial. By the time the Florida response and Gideon's reply had come in, the court was in its busiest period. Every spring the justices struggle to overcome procrastination, to compromise their differences, to finish up opinions on all the argued cases so that they can end the term in June, as scheduled, and go off to lie in the sun or make speeches at lawyers' meetings as the spirit moves them. In the office of the Chief Justice, the informa pauperis petitions may not have top priority. But the Gideon papers were again examined and summarized by a law clerk, and now his memorandum, with the full file attached, was circulated to the other eight justices. During the last week in May, the chief deputy clerk of the court, Edmund P. Cullinan, was informed that the case of Gideon V. Cochran was ready for discussion at the formal conference of the court. It was then Cullinan's duty to include the case on the next conference list, a mimeograph distributed to the justices that shows all the items ready for the next conference. Cullinan put Gideon V. Cochran on the list for the conference of Friday, June 1st. The nine justices meet in a formal conference every Friday during or preceding a week in which cases are argued or opinions announced, about three Fridays out of four during the October to June term. The conference room is an oak-paneled chamber adjoining the Chief Justice's office in the rear of the court building. Bookshelves lining the walls are filled with law reports, and there is a long, massive table in the center of the room. A single portrait of Chief Justice John Marshall looks down at the justices seated around the table. The conference has a record for secrecy probably unrivaled in official Washington. So far as is known, no one not a justice of the Supreme Court has ever been allowed into the conference room during one of the sessions. No secretaries, no law clerks, no librarians, no messengers. If a message arrives, the junior justice, the one most recently appointed, goes to the door to get it. The purpose of this absolute secrecy is twofold. It ensures against premature disclosure of the court's decisions, and it protects the privacy of the justices' discussion. The latter may be the more important reason. Genuine intellectual exchange among men of strong views is not always easy at best. It would be the more difficult if each justice had to fear public recriminations about some argument he advanced in the heat of debate. The justices must be free to argue to the hilt, without fear of reading in some popular journal that Justice X wanted another Munich. Members of the court have disclosed, however, the general way the conference is conducted. It begins at 10 a.m. and usually runs on until late in the afternoon. At the start, each justice, when he enters the room, shakes hands with all the others there, 36 handshakes altogether. The custom, dating back generations, is evidently designed to begin the meeting at a friendly level, no matter how heated the intellectual differences may be. The conference takes up, first, the applications for review, a few appeals, many more petitions for certiorari. Those on the appellate docket, the regular paid cases, are considered first, then the pauper's applications on the miscellaneous docket. If any of these are granted, They are then transferred to the appellate docket. After this, the justices consider and vote on all the cases argued during the preceding Monday through Thursday. These are tentative votes, which may be and quite often are changed as the opinion is written and the problem thought through more deeply. There may be further discussions at later conferences before the opinion is finally handed down. Because so many men are involved, with the resulting risk of chaos, the discussion follows a quite formal procedure. The Chief Justice begins the consideration of each case by stating the issue and his views. The senior associate, now Justice Black, speaks next, and so on down the line. As presiding officer, the Chief Justice shapes the character of the conference, not only by the way he first formulates the issues, but by deciding, for example, how long to let debate continue before calling for a vote. Chief Justice Hughes was regarded by some as the greatest master of the conference. "To see him preside," wrote Justice Frankfurter, "was like witnessing Toscanini lead an orchestra." But during the Hughes years, Justice Harlan F. Stone complained that the chief was too firm, too controlling. Then Stone became Chief Justice, and his colleagues protested that the conferences dragged because he was not firm enough. At the typical conference these days, the justices pass on nearly 100 matters, a formidable number. A little arithmetic will quickly indicate how impossible a burden that would impose if every justice were to talk on every case. 10 years ago, when the docket was significantly shorter than today's, Justice Jackson figured that the average conference list would permit 5 minutes of deliberation per item, or about 33 seconds of discussion per item by each of the 9 justices. "All that saves the court from being hopelessly bogged down," Jackson added, "is that many of these items are so frivolous on mere inspection that no one finds them worthy of discussion, and they are disposed of by unanimous consent." Each justice, before the weekly conference, sends to the chief's office a list of cases he considers not worthy of discussion. The cases on which all 9 are agreed are thereupon passed over at the conference. Voting in the conference is in inverse order to discussion, the junior justice first. It takes only 4 votes to grant certiorari or to put an appeal down for oral argument. The theory of having less than a majority grant review is that a case deemed important by as many as 4 justices is at least worthy of the court's consideration. The majority is always free to work its will later on the merits of the issue presented. Justice Frankfurter argued that a majority of 5 should be free, indeed, to dismiss the writ of certiorari as improvidently granted, but this view was rejected as inconsistent with the integrity of the so-called Rule of 4 for granting review. Even when there are fewer than 4 justices who personally want to take on a case, the necessary 4 votes may well be obtained by judicial log rolling. You vote for my case and I'll vote for yours. The outside world does not know how the court reaches the decision to grant or deny review of a case, or how it reaches any decision at conference, although some of these secrets have been disclosed by the publication of justices' papers. Most thoughtful persons have concluded that there should be no such publication at least until all participants in the events described have left the court, lest freedom of discussion at conference be inhibited by the fear of premature disclosure. One member of the present court was so distressed by the gossip retailed in one judicial biography that he ordered all his own papers burned, to prevent their misuse in the event of his death. At the conference of June 1, 1962, the court had before it 2 jurisdictional statements asking the court to hear appeals, 26 petitions for certiorari on the appellate docket, 10 pauper's applications on the miscellaneous docket, and 3 petitions for rehearing. The last are almost never granted. There were some important cases among these. One was a challenge to the constitutionality of New York's legislative districts. The justices decided to send this back to a federal court in New York for reconsideration in light of their recent decision in a Tennessee case that federal courts could scrutinize state legislative apportionments. Another case arose from the Freedom Rides. 6 Negroes had been convicted of breach of the peace for their effort to desegregate a Shreveport, Louisiana bus terminal. The court, having read the printed petition and response in this case, decided to grant the petition for review and then summarily to reverse the convictions for lack of any supporting evidence except the constitutionally impermissible fact that they had violated the custom of segregation. The Kohler Company of Wisconsin was asking the court to review the finding of the National Labor Relations Board that it had committed unfair labor practices in the bitter dispute, dating back to 1954, with the United Automobile Workers. The justices also considered some of the cases that had been argued earlier in the term and that now were ready for disposition. They discussed some draft opinions. They decided to put down for re-argument next fall the great dispute between Arizona and California over the water of the Colorado River. And, finally, they passed on the handwritten petition for certiorari filed by Clarence Earl Gideon, prisoner number 003826, Florida State Penitentiary, Rayford, Florida. The results of the deliberations at this conference were made known to the world shortly after 10 a.m. the following Monday, June 4th. When a clerk posted on a bulletin board the mimeographed list of the Supreme Court's orders for that day. One order read, 890 Miscellaneous, Gideon v. Cochran. The motion for leave to proceed in forma pauperis and the petition for writ of certiorari are granted. The case is transferred to the appellate docket. In addition to other questions presented by this case, counsel are requested to discuss the following in their briefs and oral argument. Should this court's holding in Betts v. Brady, 316 U.S. 455, be reconsidered? Chapter 4. In the Circuit Court of Bay County, Florida, Clarence Earl Gideon had been unable to obtain counsel. But there was no doubt that he could have a lawyer in the Supreme Court of the United States now that it had agreed to hear his case. It is the unvarying practice of the court to appoint a lawyer for any impoverished prisoner whose petition for review has been granted and who requests counsel. Appointment by the Supreme Court to represent a poor man is a great honor. For the eminent practitioner who would never otherwise dip his fingers into the criminal law, it can be an enriching experience, making him think again of the human dimensions of liberty. It may provide the first, sometimes the only, opportunity for a lawyer in some distant corner of the country to appear before the Supreme Court. It may also require great personal sacrifice. There is no monetary compensation of any kind, only the satisfaction of service. The court pays the cost of the lawyer's transportation to Washington and home, and it prints the briefs, but there is no other provision for expenses, not even secretarial help or a hotel room. The lawyer donates that most valuable commodity, his own time. A remarkable example of an appointed counsel's conception of his duty and his dedication in carrying it out was provided by a Chicago lawyer, Walter T. Fisher. Mr. Fisher was appointed on January 14, 1957, to represent one Alphonse Bartkus, who had been acquitted by a federal jury of robbing a federally insured bank in Illinois, and then had been tried and convicted in the Illinois courts for the same robbery. The Supreme Court had agreed to hear his claim that the successive prosecutions amounted to a kind of double jeopardy barred by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Mr. Fisher wrote a brief, argued the case, and lost by a tie vote of 4-4, Justice Brennan not sitting. An equal division results in what is called an affirmance by necessity of the lower court's decision. Mr. Fisher petitioned for rehearing, asking Justice Brennan to sit, and the court granted the petition. The next term Mr. Fisher wrote a new brief, argued the case again, and lost 5-4. He filed a further petition for rehearing, which was denied, but he did not consider his obligation to Bartkus or to the law ended. He asked the Illinois legislature to take action against what he still considered an injustice, and in 1959 the legislature enacted his proposal, a bill barring state prosecution of any person for a criminal act which had previously been the subject of a federal prosecution. That legislation, however, did not affect Bartkus, who remained in prison under a life sentence. Mr. Fisher filed a clemency petition, wrote letters, pleaded with the authorities. On January 3, 1961, Just short of 4 years after Mr. Fisher's appointment by the Supreme Court, Barkas's sentence was commuted to time served. Mr. Fisher found Alphonse Barkas a job and made an arrangement for him to receive continuing guidance. As a formality, the poor man whose case is to be heard by the Supreme Court must ask for a lawyer. The chief deputy clerk of the court, Edmund P. Cullinan, sees to it that he does ask. A distinguished gray-haired gentleman who joined the clerk's office while still a student at Georgetown Law School in 1930, and who has become an authority on how to proceed before the court, Cullinan has the recurrent nightmare that some prisoner will want to argue his own case. A statute allows anyone, rich or poor, lawyer or layman, to present his own case in any federal court. To forestall that possibility, he writes promptly to every prisoner whose petition the court grants. He wrote Gideon the day the court granted certiorari in his case, June 4th. An assistant clerk, Eugene T. Liddon, on the same day, sent the text of the court's order to Gideon and the Attorney General of Florida. Cullinan's letter to Gideon said, "I assume that you desire the court to appoint a competent attorney to represent you in this court. It will therefore be necessary for you to forward immediately a handwritten motion requesting the court to appoint counsel to represent you." Gideon was duly consistent in wanting a lawyer. On June 18th, his answer arrived at the court, again written in pencil on the lined prison form and stamped censored. Gideon said, "I do desire the court to appoint a competent attorney to represent me in this court, because I do not know the procedure, nor do I have the ability to do so. I make this formal request to the Supreme Court of the United States to appoint me a attorney." Like other matters decided by the Supreme Court, the choice of a lawyer for an indigent petitioner is entirely in the bosom of the justices. They have never laid out any rules for the selection process, doubtless desiring to retain a broad discretion. In the process, Justice Frankfurter once said, "Intrinsic professional competence alone matters." The court naturally tends to pick men known to one or more of the justices personally or by reputation. Mr. Fisher, for example, was an old friend of Justice Frankfurter's, and it is a fair guess that the justice suggested his name. But friendship is no assurance of a vote. Justice Frankfurter wrote the opinion of the court rejecting Mr. Fisher's argument on behalf of Alphonse Barkas. Former law clerks to the justices are often appointed. So were law professors and established practitioners. Dean Acheson was named a few years back to represent a Texas prisoner. The court frequently names someone from the same area of the country as the prisoner, but that is no rule. In general, it can be said that counsel appointed in the pauper's cases are much superior to the average lawyer who appears in the Supreme Court. The average level, unfortunately, is mediocre at best, reflecting the bar generally, since there is no special group of lawyers who argue in the Supreme Court. The question of counsel for Gideon was ready for discussion at the court's conference of Friday, June 22, 1962. That was the last conference of the term, as it happened. The following Monday, the court handed down all its remaining opinions, including the controversial decision on the New York Regent's Prayer, and recessed for the summer. Shortly after the conference ended, Chief Justice Warren called in the clerk of the court, John F. Davis. The clerk is the court's ranking employee, and the job is one of distinction. Davis's predecessor, James R. Browning, is now a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and before he was named clerk in 1961, Davis had argued more than 50 Supreme Court cases for the government, including the DuPont General Motors antitrust case. One of the clerk's duties is to help with the mechanical arrangements for translating Friday's conference decisions into the printed and mimeographed orders released the following Monday. When a lawyer is being appointed to represent an indigent, Davis also has the job of informally advising him over the weekend so that he may indicate if he has some personal difficulty that would make it impossible for him to accept the assignment. The court does not want the mutual embarrassment of having a formal appointment turned down. But the court's appointment of counsel in these circumstances is a little like a presidential invitation to dine. Few are turned down. On this Friday evening, Chief Justice Warren told Davis that the court had selected Abe Fortas of Washington to represent Gideon. Davis put in a call for Fortas and found him eventually in Dallas. Fortas said he would be happy to serve as counsel for Clarence Earl Gideon. He asked what the issue was in Gideon's case. Briefly, but quite clearly indicating the large stakes, Davis told him, the court had agreed to reconsider the limits put on the right to counsel by Betts v. Brady. The next Monday, the court entered this order in the case of Gideon v. Cochran. The motion for appointment of counsel is granted, and it is ordered that Abe Fortas Esquire of Washington, D.C., a member of the bar of this court, be, and he is hereby appointed to serve as counsel for petitioner in this case. Abe Fortas is a high-powered example of that high-powered species, the Washington lawyer. He is the driving force in the firm of Arnold, Thurman Arnold, who was Franklin Roosevelt's trust buster and then a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, resigning because he found the bench stultifying, Fortas and Porter, Paul A. Porter, former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. The firm has 30 lawyers, making it substantial in size, though nothing like the colossi of Wall Street. It is not what could be called an establishment law firm. It is too aggressive or insufficiently stodgy, according to one's point of view. Judge Arnold, as a Yale law professor in the 1930s, was one of the great legal realists, writing books, for example, The Folklore of Capitalism, a classic of law and politics, in which he sought to puncture the myths about judges and portrayed them as men, not priests, with ideas and even prejudices. The realists emphasized what judges did, as opposed to what they said, and recognized that law was not logic alone, but that it reflected judges' social, economic, and psychological conceptions. Something of this irreverence pervades Arnold, Fortas, and Porter. There is a heavy Yale influence, and Yale is popularly supposed to regard law more as a social tool and less as the intellectual exercise attributed to Harvard. Generalizations aside, it is probably true that Yale Law School puts less emphasis on the niceties of arriving at a legal result and more on the social significance of the result. Certainly, this realism is in the air at Arnold, Fortas, and Porter. Of the three names in the firm title, only Porter is not a Yale law graduate. He is a product of Kentucky and the University of Kentucky Law School, and still has the fine political style of the Kentuckian. All three are graduates of the New Deal, and it is not surprising that the firm has a liberal and democratic flavor. Fortas is an old friend and counselor of Lyndon Johnson, and was one of the first men called in to help when Johnson assumed the presidency. Lawyers from Arnold, Fortas, and Porter do drafting and other behind-the-scenes work for liberal legislation in Congress. The firm played an important part in the legal fight against the use of anonymous informers in the government's loyalty and security programs. One victim whose case it took to the Supreme Court but lost was taken on as an AFP employee and is still there. But the firm is anything but a do-good outfit. It is interested in making money, and it does so in a widely varied practice emphasizing litigation against the government, antitrust law, tax law, and practice before the federal regulatory agencies. The premier business getter is Abe Fortas. Fortas had just turned 52 when he got the assignment in the Gideon case. He was born to a modest Jewish family in Memphis on June 19, 1910, went to Southwestern College there, and then moved into the great world through the Yale Law School. He was editor-in-chief of the Law Journal, the earliest sure sign of intellectual distinction and willpower in a lawyer. After graduation in 1933, he went to Washington and worked for such New Deal luminaries as William O. Douglas, who had been his professor at Yale, Jerome Frank, and Harold Ickes. In 1942, at the age of 32, he became Undersecretary of the Interior. Francis Biddle, who was Attorney General at the time, tells a wonderfully Rooseveltian story about Fortas, really about FDR. Ickes was out of town, and Fortas sat in for him at a cabinet meeting. The president, who was asking each cabinet member in turn to report, could not remember Fortas's name and passed a note down the table asking for help. Mr. Biddle writes, Fortas, I whispered, and his name was relayed to the president, who then wrote on a pad, not his last name, his first name. And when, going around the table, he came to Abe, the president asked, well, Abe, what's been going on in Interior? In 1946, Fortas left the Department of the Interior for private practice. He is known now as one of the country's outstanding appellate advocates, skilled in the special technique of arguing cases to appellate judges that is so largely neglected in this country. In the Supreme Court, he has represented, among others, Lever Brothers Company and George Parr, known as the Duke of Duval, the old-fashioned Democratic boss of Duval County, Texas, whose conviction for mail fraud Fortas managed to get reversed. But Fortas's most important activities as a lawyer take place not in courtrooms, but in the offices of corporations. He advises business executives on how to enlarge their market power and their profits while staying within the myriad rules laid down by government. He flies around the country to attend meetings, to handle negotiations, to discuss finances and corporate structure as much as the law. One acquaintance says his business is corporate wheeling and dealing, adding respectfully, he is one of our big social engineers. He is unusual in doing so many things well as a lawyer: antitrust litigation, practice at administrative agencies, appellate argument, corporate counseling. His clients include Federated Department Stores, Unilever, Investors Diversified Services, Cyrus Eaton, and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. He knows Governor Luis Munoz Marin intimately. He also represents the Casals Festival. He is an old friend of Pablo Casals and arranged Casals' performance at the White House. Unlike most prominent lawyers, Fortas has had an interest in criminal law, though more on the philosophical side than in practice. He argued and won the Durham case, in which the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia laid down a new criminal insanity rule that has had repercussions throughout this country and abroad. The court abandoned the old doctrine that a man escaped the responsibility for a criminal act only if he could not tell right from wrong, substituting the broader rule that an accused is not criminally responsible if his unlawful act was the product of mental disease or defect. He is a member of a committee appointed by Chief Justice Warren to recommend changes in the rules of procedure for federal criminal cases, and it could have been his association with the Chief Justice in this work that led to his appointment in the Gideon case. But he is also a friend of Justices Black, Brennan, and Douglas, and one of them might have suggested his name. Fortas is a smallish man with a manner that can be grave or, especially with women, charming. There is a nice touch of Mephistopheles. His speech has a slow, deliberate quality with tangible intellectual force, the word may be tension, behind it. It is hard to imagine him being entirely spontaneous. Not that he lacks humor, but he always seems controlled. A lawyer who has worked with him says, "Of all the men I have met, he most knows why he is doing what he does. I don't like the SOB. But if I were in trouble, I'd want him on my side. He's the most resourceful, the boldest, the most thorough lawyer I know." If Fortas has any one hero in the law, it is Justice Brandeis, and that says a good deal about Fortas. Brandeis was the supreme craftsman, probably the ablest lawyer ever to sit on the court. He was a notably unsentimental man, one who had no qualms about voting against widows or orphans in furtherance of some longer-run interest in the law. But he also had deep social convictions and fought for liberal causes throughout his life. With the Brandeis model in mind, a colleague has said of Fortas, "He values craftsmanship most highly. He is no sentimentalist, and he works for reform of the criminal law because he thinks it is right for society, not because of any illusions about criminals. But under his sobriety and detachment, there is passionate conviction. He is an angry man, angry at injustice." Evidently, Fortas enjoys the grand style. He and his wife, Carolyn Agger, an expert tax lawyer, drive a Rolls-Royce. He explains that it is really an economical investment. They have many contemporary works of art in their Georgetown home, but also antique furniture and Chinese scrolls and paintings. The firm is in what was once a Victorian private home, and Fortis's office is dominated by a huge desk made from a Victorian grand piano. There are wing chairs, a soft couch, paintings and mementos of Casals, and other great friends. A lawyer preparing a case for the Supreme Court has more freedom than might generally be expected. His material has to a large extent been determined by the proceedings in the lower courts, but he can artistically shape that material because he has the choice of facts to emphasize and legal theories to advance for the desired result. For example, a man may have been convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to answer a subcommittee's questions about his asserted communist affiliations. That seems simple enough, but the intellectual ore that lawyers have mined from such contempt records is rich indeed. Was the committee authorized by the House or Senate to conduct this inquiry? Had it passed the authority on to this subcommittee? Did the subcommittee follow its own rules? Were the questions pertinent to the official subject of investigation? Was this pertinence explained to the witness? Was the subject of inquiry adequately stated in the indictment and proved at the trial? These are some of the questions that appellate counsel have found in the cold records of congressional contempt proceedings in the last decade and argued, often successfully, to the Supreme Court. The court's discretion is as great as the advocate's in selecting the issue for decision, so that it is often difficult to predict on what ground a case will be decided, much less which side will win. The shaping of the facts and the issues into a Supreme Court case is the job of the advocate. The brief and argument that finally appear are only the visible part of the iceberg, the end of a long process of selection and decision and imagination. It was this process on which Fortis and others in his law firm embarked at the end of June. The first step was to look over the papers that had been filed so far in the Gideon case. A young associate in the firm went up to the clerk's office of the court to read them, and photostats were later made for the Arnold, Fortis, and Porter files. These papers were meager. Gideon's petition for review, Florida's response, the rebuttal by Gideon, a copy of his original application for habeas corpus in the Florida Supreme Court, and that court's cryptic denial of it. From these, Fortis, or any other interested person, could know only a skeleton of the case. The charge, the conviction, the sentence, Gideon's demand for a lawyer, the rejection of that demand. There were no details about the prisoner or the crime or the trial. Nothing, for example, to indicate what a lawyer might have done for Gideon by way of defense that Gideon did not do for himself. The few facts before Fortis were enough to raise the legal question that the Supreme Court had directed him to argue. Should Betts v. Brady be reconsidered and an absolute requirement of counsel be imposed? As the bare record stood, Florida conceded that Gideon was a poor felony defendant whose request for appointed counsel had been denied. Those facts alone, as an abstract proposition, Fortis could argue, constituted a denial of due process of law. Moreover, technically speaking, only this skeleton of the Gideon case could serve as the basis for the Supreme Court's adjudication. The court ordinarily will consider only the record that was before the lower court. Counsel may not, as an afterthought, try to introduce new evidence. And in Gideon's case, the only document that had been before the Florida Supreme Court was the habeas corpus petition that it rejected. It had no transcript of the trial or other information. The Florida court regarded Gideon's constitutional claim as so weak, or so obviously foreclosed by Betts v. Brady, to put it another way, that factual detail was irrelevant. But it is against the Anglo-American legal tradition to argue cases in so abstract a setting. A lawyer wants the smell of flesh and blood. He wants a human being for a client, not an abstract principle. And Fortis had been assigned to represent Clarence Earl Gideon, not an abstraction. There was always the chance that a closer examination of the facts in his case would show another reason for setting aside his conviction, a ground easier for the Supreme Court to accept than one that would require overruling of its own precedent. As one example, the trial record might disclose one of the special circumstances entitling a man to a free lawyer under the Betts v. Brady rule. Gideon might have been insane or hopelessly incompetent, or the judge might have shown prejudice, or the case against him might have been a particularly complicated or legally subtle one. If Gideon could win in the Supreme Court on any such ground, it was Fortas's duty to Gideon to argue that point, even though the result was to eliminate the case as a broad test of the right to counsel. There are few things Supreme Court justices like less than a lawyer who puts his client's interest aside in the zeal to make some great change in the law. All of these considerations were in Fortas's mind. They presented what he called a moral problem. Whether he should try to find out more about what had happened to Clarence Earl Gideon, in particular, whether he should get a transcript of his trial. "The real question," Fortas said, "was whether I should urge upon the court the special circumstances doctrine. As the record then stood, there was nothing to show that he had suffered from any special circumstances. But if he went behind that bare record, there might be. There was the risk, if it did turn out that Gideon had some special difficulty, that this whole case would turn out to be an anticlimax, just another case of the Supreme Court freeing a single prisoner without laying down any new rule on the right to counsel. But my duty was to Gideon. If I hadn't gotten the record up, I'd never know. If I lost the case, I'd always worry, is the poor guy in jail because I didn't do my job?" Fortas decided to get the trial transcript. He telephoned Chief Deputy Clerk Cullinan, who arranges such things for the Supreme Court. Cullinan wrote to the Circuit Court of Bay County, Florida, and before long a transcript of Gideon's trial was typed by the local court reporter from her notes, certified by the clerk of the Circuit Court, and mailed to Washington. Chapter 5. Gideon was tried on August 4, 1961, by Judge Robert L. McCrary, Jr., and a jury of six men. At the start, after Gideon's unsuccessful attempt to obtain a lawyer, Judge McCrary asked the jurors whether they would give him the same fair trial and consideration, since he is not represented by counsel, that you would if he were represented. The transcript shows a joint reply: "Yes, sir." The court: "Now, Mr. Gideon, look these six gentlemen over, and if you don't want them to sit as a jury to try your case, just point out the one or more, all six of them if you want to, and the court will excuse them, and we will call another or some others to try your case. You don't have to have a reason. Just look them over, and if you don't like their looks, that's all it takes to get them excused." The defendant: "They suit me all right, Your Honor." The judge, as Fortas noted when he read the transcript, was obviously trying to protect Gideon, but did not inform him of his right to question each juror for possible bias. Ordinarily, in a criminal case, the prosecutor and the defense counsel make opening statements to the jury, indicating what they expect to prove. The prosecutor, Assistant State Attorney William E. Harris, made his statement, and then Judge McCrary let Gideon address the jury. "Just walk right around there where you can see them," the judge said, "and tell them what you expect the evidence to show in your favor. Talk loud enough for them to hear you now." Apparently, under Florida practice, the court reporter does not take down opening statements. The transcript noted only that Mr. Harris read to the jury the formal charge against Gideon, that on June 3, 1961, he did unlawfully and feloniously break and enter a building of another, to wit, the Bay Harbor Pool Room, property of Ira Strickland, Jr., lessee, with intent to commit a misdemeanor within said building, to wit, petty larceny. The prosecution's principal witness was one Henry Cook of 108 East Avenue, Panama City, otherwise unidentified. He testified that he was outside the Bay Harbor Pool Room at 5:30 in the morning that June 3rd, and saw Gideon inside. He knew Gideon. After a few minutes watching through the window, Cook testified, he saw Gideon come out with a pint of wine in his hand, make a telephone call at the street corner, and get into a taxi that he had apparently called. After following Gideon to the telephone booth, he went back to the pool room and saw it had been broken into. The front was off the cigarette machine, and its money box was lying on a pool table. That was the direct testimony, and it was damaging. Then, briefly, Gideon attempted to cross-examine Cook. He asked what Cook was doing outside the pool room at 5:30 in the morning. Cook said he had just come from a dance down in Apalachicola, stayed out all night, and then this potentially interesting line of inquiry was dropped. Gideon asked whether Cook had ever been arrested, but the prosecutor's objection to that question was sustained by Judge McCrary. Gideon was allowed to ask whether Cook had ever been convicted of a felony. Cook said no. The rest of the cross-examination was a meandering, argumentative affair that got nowhere. Question: do you know positively that I was carrying a pint of wine? Answer: yes, I know you was. Question: how do you know that? Answer: because I seen it in your hand. Nothing further was brought out about Cook's age, his occupation, his relationship with Gideon, his reputation, all areas that a lawyer would certainly have explored. There was only one other witness for the prosecution, Ira Strickland, Jr., operator of the Bay Harbor pool room. He testified that he had closed the place up at midnight on June 2, 1961, locking all doors and windows. When he returned the next morning at 8 o'clock, he found the deputy sheriff. A window had been smashed, he said, and a cigarette machine and jukebox broken into. Someone had taken coins from the two machines. Strickland said he did not know how much money was missing, and a small amount of beer and some wine. On cross-examination, Gideon asked a number of questions about what the Bay Harbor pool room looked like, and the jury learned that it had a long bar down one side. Gideon had 8 witnesses for the defense. Before they were called at his request, Judge McCrary warned him, without any real legal basis, so far as Fortas could tell, that the witnesses you call are your witnesses, and it's up to you to vouch for them. You understand that, do you? Gideon answered, yes, sir, I understand it. His first witness was the policeman who had discovered the break-in at the Bay Harbor pool room, Henry Berryhill, Jr. He said he had not been summoned by anyone, not, for example, by Cook, but had found the front door of the pool room open on a routine patrol. He checked with a fellow at the front of the building, a Mr. Cook, and he said he saw you leave the building. Gideon asked nothing further about what Berryhill thought Cook was doing at the front of the building at that hour. Berryhill testified that he had called the deputy sheriff, Dewell Pitts, Jr., to investigate the break-in. After a few questions, Berryhill was excused. Just why Gideon had called the policeman as a defense witness remained unclear. Deputy Sheriff Pitts was next, and his status as a defense witness was just as obscure. He said Cook had seen Gideon in the building, and he was satisfied with that evidence of the crime. Then came the cab driver who had picked Gideon up on that morning of June 3rd, Preston Bray. Gideon had little to ask except whether he had seemed drunk that morning. He pressed Bray successfully to say no. Actually, under Florida law, intoxication would have been a defense to this crime. Gideon evidently did not know that, but a lawyer would have. The prosecutor, on cross-examination, brought out that Bray had known Gideon for some time and asked whether Gideon was unemployed. Bray answered, "I know he was working at the pool room. Now, whether he was getting paid or not, I don't know." That was significant, because Gideon could conceivably have had an excuse for being in the pool room after closing if he was an employee, but the subject was never explored further. A Mrs. Irene Rhodes testified that she had been on the front porch of her house, down the street from the pool room, on the morning of the crime. Gideon asked next whether she had bought him a drink in the pool room the night before. "I probably did if you needed one," Mrs. Rhodes said, and their relationship was left at that. Gideon brought out that she had seen him come out of the alley at the rear of the pool hall that morning, hardly a point for the defense, but Mrs. Rhodes agreed with him that that was not unusual because he lived nearby and he often used the public telephone booth on the street. On cross-examination, Mrs. Rhodes said she had gone down to the telephone booth to ask Gideon whether the pool room bar was open because she knew he helps out in there occasionally. Again, nothing more was made of that. She saw a partly full wine bottle outside the booth and brought it to her landlord because he was sick. The next three witnesses were the owner of the building in which the Bay Harbor pool room was located and two pool room employees. They added nothing. Gideon's last witness was his landlady, Mrs. Velva Estelle Morris, the owner of the Bay Harbor Hotel, across the street from the pool room. She testified that Gideon usually went out to the public telephone when he had to make a call during the night to avoid disturbing others by using the hotel telephone. Then, again ignoring the possible legal benefit of intoxication, Gideon asked these questions. Question: Mrs. Morris, during the time I lived at the hotel, did you ever know of me being out drunk? Answer: No. Question: Did you ever see me drunk? Answer: No. Question: Did you ever hear of me getting drunk? Answer: No. That was the case for the defense. Gideon then made a final argument to the jury, which was not transcribed. The court reporter noted only that he talked to them for approximately 11 minutes, emphasizing his innocence. The prosecutor took only 9 minutes for his final argument, which was also not recorded. Then the judge charged the jury, saying in straightforward terms that it could find Gideon guilty if it determined that the crime was committed in Bay County within the last 2 years and by Gideon. Fortas noted later that the judge had not explained any of the elements of the crime as defined by the Florida Supreme Court, such as the requisite intent to commit petty larceny after breaking and entering. Gideon had not requested such a charge by the judge, as a lawyer might have, but then he was never told that he had the right to make such a request. The jury found Gideon guilty. Judge McCrary delayed the sentencing for 3 weeks in order to get a report on Gideon's past history. On August 25th, without any argument by Gideon, or, of course, by a lawyer on his behalf, the judge imposed the maximum sentence of 5 years. When that transcript was read at Arnold, Fortas, and Porter, there was no longer any question about the appropriateness of this case as the vehicle to challenge Betts v. Brady. Plainly, Gideon was not mentally defective. The charge against him and the proof were not particularly complicated. The judge had tried to be fair. At least there was no overt bias in the courtroom. In short, Gideon had not suffered from any of the special circumstances that would have entitled him to a lawyer under the limited rule of Betts v. Brady. And yet it was altogether clear that a lawyer would have helped. The trial had been a rudimentary one, with a prosecution case that was fragmentary at best. Gideon had not made a single objection or pressed any of the favorable lines of defense. An Arnold, Fortas, and Porter associate said later, "We knew as soon as we read that transcript that here was a perfect case to challenge the assumption of Betts that a man could have a fair trial without a lawyer. He did very well for a layman. He acted like a lawyer, but it was a pitiful effort, really. He may have committed this crime, but it was never proved by the prosecution. A lawyer, not a great lawyer, just an ordinary competent lawyer, could have made ashes of the case." But Abe Fortas's curiosity was not satisfied. There was still mystery about Clarence Earl Gideon, his character, his history. The trial transcript had been singularly uninformative about the human beings involved, except for a general air of shabbiness. Fortas considered going to see his client in the state prison at Rayford, Florida. "I thought I should find out something about his background, in case a question should come up," Fortas said later. "One question, for example, was whether I should refer to the severity of the sentence, 5 years for breaking and entering with intent to commit a misdemeanor. He came out of this bar with a bottle of red eye in his hand. It was a petty crime. It occurred to me that I might make some indignant statement about the severity of that sentence, but then there could be a reason I didn't know. Another thing I specifically wanted to find out was whether he was a Negro. All these things suggested that I see him. On the other hand, there was the chance of involvement and of going improperly outside the record of this case. I decided against seeing Gideon, but as it turned out, I was able to satisfy my doubts by correspondence." The correspondence was started by Gideon. On August 1st, he wrote Fortas that he had had a letter from the clerk of the Supreme Court informing me that you were appointed to represent me in my litigation. I have not heard from you, Gideon continued, and I would like to find out if you are going to represent me, because I don't know what to do. Fortas replied that he was